This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. With gas prices high and, everybody says, going higher amid global competition for energy and in the midst of deepening economic gloom, is this the moment to challenge the country to take bold and maybe expensive steps to fight global warming? And after all the lectures and slideshows, panel discussions and speeches, can activists cut through green fatigue and sell the message? In a moment, we'll talk about that first subject with Al Gore, the former vice president and Nobel Peace Prize winner, makes a major address today on energy and global warming. A bit later, we'll focus on selling the green message with people who make advertisements and movies. What does it take to break through the green fog? Or if you're just plain sick of it, what does it take to overcome green fatigue? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blog of the nation. Later in the hour, photographer Warren Zinn reflects on the iconic photograph he took of an American soldier in Iraq and that soldier's subsequent suicide. But first, former Vice President Al Gore joins us from DAR Constitution Hall, where today he delivered a speech on global warming. And Mr. Vice President, nice to have you on the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
And you've called today that America produce all its electricity by process of renewable sources like solar and wind within 10 years. And it's nice to know that you still have a lot of ambitions.
Well, the cost of solar power and wind power, geothermal power, has come down dramatically as the price of oil and coal have gone up dramatically. They're now competitive, and the cost reductions are continuing and accelerating because the fuel is free, the sunshine and the wind and the natural geothermal energy from the earth, and the scientists and engineers are finding more ingenious ways to make the equipment that translates that energy into electricity much more effective and efficient.
So this would call for all electrical generation to be by those renewable sources, plus I would suspect nuclear power as well, phasing out coal and natural gas and oil-fired plants. But, of course, we'd still be using a lot of petroleum for American cars.
Yes, but once we have a unified national grid with a renewable electricity production system, it becomes possible to shift over to electric vehicles. Automakers in Detroit and Japan and Germany and elsewhere have massive plans now to shift to the production of electric vehicles. There are many new vehicles in the works. And no wonder, because with gasoline at $4 and $5 a gallon, it's possible to run an electric car on the equivalent of $1 a gallon gasoline. And as we shift our electricity grid over to more renewable sources, the electric car is going to be a much bigger part of our fleet. Now, that'll take some time. That'll take a little more time. And the quickest and best way to start using renewable energy is in the electricity generation sector.
And as you know, Americans are stinging from the price that fuel costs them now, and it's certainly likely to get worse come winter time when they have to pay to heat houses as well. Is this the time, and a lot of people say, this is going to cost money, this is going to be more expensive than what we've got now?
Well, no, nothing could be more expensive than continuing to import 70% of our oil from foreign countries when China and other growing economies are bidding up the price on a daily basis. It's going to continue to go up in price, and the growth in demand is completely overwhelming the declining rate of new discoveries. The only way to get relief from rising gasoline prices is a breakout strategy, to break free of the trap that we're in because of our overdependence on fossil fuels, principally oil and coal. Luckily, we do now have alternatives that are cost-effective, and in a few short years, a national commitment to renewable energy can bring the cost of car travel down by shifting over to renewable energy.
Yet, as we go ahead on this, sacrifices, is the country in the mood for sacrifices now as we face difficult economic times? And a lot of people don't agree with you that this is going to be a painless transition.
Well, the oil companies don't agree, and The fact is, people are making sacrifices now to pay these high gasoline prices, and 70% of the money is going overseas. If we make a national commitment to install solar panels and windmills and geothermal plants, that money stays here and strengthens our economy. When we burn more oil, the price goes up. When we build more solar panels and windmills, the price of renewable energy goes down. So it's the investment that makes sense, and it will pay itself back many times over.
Let's see if we get some callers in on the conversation. Our guest, of course, former Vice President Al Gore, who made a major speech today here in Washington, D.C., on global warming and energy. 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And Jody's on the line. Jody with us from Birmingham, Alabama.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much for letting me be on your show. I enjoy it so much.
Thank you.
My comment is, Mr. Vice President, is what has happened to American ingenuity? We used to look at challenges by saying, we're going to roll up our sleeves, we can tackle it, we're going to win. Now we're presented with a problem, and as a nation, we collectively say, it's too tough, we can't deal with it. I'll listen off the air. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Jody.
Well, I agree with you, and yet there are so many of us who share that sentiment that we're now beginning to see a change. We do need leadership, and we need a commitment at the national level to build a unified national electricity grid and to put in place the policies that will speed up this transition to renewable energy. The spirit of innovation is alive, and the good news is that particularly since oil and coal prices have gone up, the amount of private investment flowing into the creation of new renewable sources has really grown dramatically.
Let's get Jerry on the line, and Jerry's calling us from Detroit, Michigan.
Hi, I just got back from Germany yesterday, and I rented a car, drove from Berlin to the Baltic Sea, and was amazed to see how many windmill farms there were along the Autobahn, and it made me realize just how far behind we are. And my question to you, Mr. Gore, is what is the big hurdle with politicians of why we can't get this passed through? I mean, I know you've been a proponent of this for a long time, but nothing happened while you were under Bill Clinton's administration. So my question is, why couldn't you get anything passed through? And what's it going to take today to get our leaders to get this kind of policy through?
And just to clarify, I'm sure Jerry's talking not about those picture postcard windmills, but the ones that are used to generate from the wind electricity. Vice President Gore, go ahead, please.
Correct.
Absolutely, and I've made a trip similar to that one, and I, too, was astounded at how many of these modern windmills are in use in Europe and especially in Germany. And by the way, they have far more solar panels than the entire United States, even though they're a much smaller country. And the reason is they have national laws to encourage the use of renewable energy. I tried hard to get such laws passed here in the United States. It was not for lack of trying that the Congress did not take my recommendations. And that experience is the explanation for why I'm devoting my life now to trying to change the public opinion in America to encourage the politicians in both parties to support such policies. This initiative in our current political system really does require a demand from the people. When that comes, the politicians will respond.
Thanks for the call, Jerry. Let's see if we can go now to Jane. And Jane is calling us from, are you in New York?
Hello.
Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, hello?
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, wonderful. What an honor to talk to Mr. Gore. I get your newsletter. I get your emails. I love it. I am calling because, and I'll take my answer off the air, our current president has proposed that we drill for America in somewhat protected lands and all over just to make the cost of oil go down. I would like to know what you would do if he put you in charge of that program, which I think is a super idea if we put you in charge of that. So I'd like to know what you would do. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Jane, thanks for the call.
Yes, Jane, thank you for your kind words before your question. And I personally believe that there's a logical disconnect between the idea of opening up these protected areas to oil drilling and the desire to bring short-term gasoline prices down. The two don't connect up because, first of all, the demand for oil is growing so rapidly that the price is almost certainly going to continue to go up until we shift away from a dependence on oil and coal and towards renewable energy. None of that oil would be produced for at least 10 years, and so it would not have any effect on the price of gasoline. And even then, it could simply be shipped farther west and sold to China because they're bidding up the price of oil and buying a lot of oil away from us. Giving more money to the oil companies is not a way to bring down gasoline prices. Shifting to renewable energy and electric vehicles is the way to get the equivalent of $1 a gallon gasoline.
We just have 1 minute left with you. I know you've got a bunch of interviews scheduled for today, but I do need to ask you that, gee, wouldn't the vice president's office be a swell place to push this agenda? If Senator Obama called, would you take his call and maybe take a suggestion?
Well, thank you for the question, but I've imposed a personal term limit of only 2 terms as vice president.
And you've already served those 2.
Correct.
Al Gore.
More seriously, I believe my role is to build public opinion and support of solutions to the climate crisis, and that's what I'm going to do.
Well, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Former Vice President Al Gore, a winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. I think he got an Oscar, too. He joins us today from DAR Constitution Hall here in Washington, D.C. Coming up, we'll move from the green message itself to selling that message. We'll talk with some of the creative brains at the Martin Ad Agency next, and we'll still take your calls. How do you cut through green fatigue and the confusion about all these goals, green fog, if you will, and get people to come on board, the unpersuaded, who may not have been listening to Vice President Gore at DAR Constitution Hall earlier today. We'd appreciate your phone calls. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We were just speaking with former Vice President Al Gore about the green message. Now we focus on how to sell that message to the unpersuaded. Even an award-winning PowerPoint presentation may not reach everybody. When Al Gore wanted a different approach, he went to the Martin Agency, a company that's designed marketing campaigns for Alltel, NASCAR, and Sirius Radio. Those Geico cavemen, they came up with that, too. The Alliance for Climate Protection wanted to get everyday Americans from all walks of life interested in the movement to curb climate change. The Martin Agency came up with the We campaign, a series of advertisements that featured unlikely pairs, Nancy Pelosi and Newt Gingrich, and Al Sharpton and Pat Robertson.
Al, let's face it, we're polar opposites.
We couldn't be further apart. I'm on the left.
And I'm usually right. And we strongly disagree.
Except on one issue. Tell them what it is, Reverend Pat.
That would be our planet. Taking care of it is extremely important.
We all need to work together, liberals and conservatives.
So get involved. It's the right thing to do.
Now there you go again.
An ad for the Alliance for Climate Protection with Al Sharpton and Pat Robertson. Matt Williams is an executive vice president at the Martin Agency. He supervised the Alliance for Climate Protection program. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
And Mike Hughes is the president and creative director of the company. And thank you for coming in as well.
It's good to be here.
They're both with us here in Studio 3A, and good to have them with us. If you're part of the great unpersuaded, tell us what it would take to break through the green fog and green fatigue. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And Matt, let me ask you, this campaign, you had to approach this rather differently than, say, NASCAR.
Yeah, well, it all began with understanding how people think about this issue. And what we found, Neil, when we talked to those folks is that there's actually a very high level of engagement in the climate crisis issue. And the question more people were asking was, how can I get involved and what can I do? Mm-hmm. One of the things we're trying to do with the We campaign is make it clear to people that the issue of the climate crisis is not a partisan issue. It's one that spans across ideologies and across party party boundaries.
Well, it is and it isn't. There are plenty of people who would disagree with you.
Well, yeah, I think the climate crisis will not discriminate on whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. So the idea needs to be to pull people in from different parts of the debate and agree on the fact that we need to come together as a society to demand changes in the laws and in the way we behave as people to solve this problem, because mm-hmm. it threatens all of us.
And the approach, obviously, you're taking a very serious issue and dealing with it in a humorous vein.
Yeah. You know, one of the things we learn about when we talk to people, whether it's about car insurance or the climate crisis, is that you have to make the message palatable to folks. And, you know, the climate crisis can be a scary topic.
Cars would be a very boring topic.
It can be that, too. But it's actually very exciting if you think about it optimistically. And if you give people the acknowledgement that there is urgency around this issue, but the optimism that it can also be solved. And that solvability was a really important component of the campaign. Let's bring people together around the need for us to demand changes in the laws to solve this crisis.
One of the things that's so exciting about this right now, and Mr. Gore has talked about this, is that for our parents and grandparents, they could be the greatest generation by winning World War II. This is our chance to show what we can do as a generation. What can we do out in the market? In the world, to make the world a better place, and a place where there are more jobs, and there are the air is cleaner, and everything is running better. We're all frustrated right now, Democrats and Republicans alike, with society not quite feeling like it's working correctly. We need to repower America to make it work more efficiently. Create those American jobs. Create. Energy that doesn't rely on limited amounts of fuel.
When you got this this contract to do this this campaign, how did you start to frame it for people like Matt?
You know, it's hard when you start a campaign like this not to try to define an enemy and go after the enemy. But we decided that this would be about hope and not about fear.
Mm-hmm.
And we were deciding this last summer,
so
before
it's
the politicians.
This is your brain on drugs.
Yeah.
So.
That's right. We could have gone that way.
Sure.
And that's tempting. But we're asking people to sign up for a long-term change. What the vice president called for today was a 10-year program to get us from where we are to where we want to be in an energy safe world. And so we needed a long campaign. Just like when we do work for GEICO, we want people to like GEICO more.
Mm-hmm.
We want people to like being part of this campaign. Mr. Gore has said this is we are privileged to be able to take on this problem. And that's an interesting way to look at it. This is a privilege to be able to take on something this big.
Matt, I'm sure privilege was not the thought that may have occurred to you some nights as you were tearing your hair out trying to figure out how to approach this campaign. And obviously coming up with the idea of bringing two very disparate kinds of people
right.
together on couches in various kinds of settings.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Reverends Al and Pat are sitting on a couch in front of, looks like, the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. Well, we started thinking, how can we communicate to folks that to move forward on the solutions for the climate crisis, we need to stop arguing around partisan politics. We need to come together beyond that, because this is a problem that's bigger than that. So we thought, you know, who can we get that represents two people who you would never think would agree on anything, who actually agree on this issue and are willing to work together? And the idea being, if Al Sharpton and Pat Robertson can come together around this, we all should be able to come together around it.
And I have to assume, let me ask, I shouldn't assume, did they do it for the money?
They didn't do it for the money, I can promise you that.
Nobody's getting rich on this campaign.
Let's see if we can get some callers on the line. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And this is Ravi. Ravi with us from Charlottesville, in Virginia.
Yes, yeah, I have a question for you. I'm fascinated by this topic. I work for a campaign called The Greenest School in America, and we're working to build one of the first LEED Platinum elementary schools in America here in Charlottesville, Virginia, for the Waldorf School.
Mm-hmm.
And we're finding it's true that there is a lot of fatigue in terms of people hearing the green message so often that you kind of get lost in the shuffle. And so our platform, when it started about 4 years ago, fresh and new, and as time has worn on, it has become less so. So I'm looking for advice on what we can do to get donors engaged, and corporate sponsorship, that type of thing, engaged in our project in the midst of all of this. And the thing that's somewhat unique about our project is that we're trying to build at a LEED Platinum level, but affordably, which has traditionally not been the case with school building at a LEED level.
Well, you've gotten through to get some free advice from a very expensive agency. Matt Williams?
Yeah, thank you for the question. One of the things we've tried to do with the WE campaign is make this issue not just feel global, which obviously it is, but bring it to life on a local level. So if you go to WeCanSolveIt.org, you'll find local chapters of WE that can meet in your communities and talk about what your community can do. And it sounds like you have a great opportunity to take what can be a very large and difficult to get your head around issue and make it feel very local. And if you can make people understand the local personal benefits of helping you achieve what you're trying to achieve, it can make this feel much more real for people.
So, and any glaciers melting there in Charlottesville?
No, it's a pretty hot day, though.
The other thing you have as an advantage is that you're dealing with kids, and all of this is about making a better world for the kids. Once the kids get involved in this, and they love getting involved in this, and they nag all of us parents about how we're going to help and address this issue, maybe there's ways to get the kids more involved.
Okay, absolutely. Great. I appreciate the advice.
Good luck, Ravi.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye. And let me ask you, Mike, her problem is not unique. These messages have to you were talking about GEICO, for example, mm-hmm. and how much you want people to like them. They've got three or four different campaigns going at the same. They've got the chameleon.
They've got the gecko, the caveman,
the real gecko.
Good news. I just saved a bunch
of money. Costume. And all, right. There's all kinds of things going. These messages have to be renewed and ongoing. Isn't that sustainability in and of itself a challenge on this issue too?
Yes, it is. It's something that we're going to have to keep our eyes open. And I think I know you're going to be seeing some new things from us to freshen our whole approach to this in the days and weeks ahead. When Mr. Gore talked today in his talk about solutions, and that's going to be a big part of what we talk about for the next few months. The biggest question we get these days isn't, there's nothing that can be done. It's, what can I do? I've changed my light bulbs. What else can I do?
Let's see if we get Mike on the line, and Mike's calling us from Hollywood in Florida.
How you doing? A while back on Nickelodeon, there was a show called Mr. Wizard, where the mother made her children ride a bike, a stationary bike, for 2 hours, which would power a television for 45 minutes. And I was wondering, if you were to take like a hotel or an old hotel or an apartment building, each room could fit about 10 stationary bikes. You fill it with people who are either low income or even homeless, and you could have them all pedal and maybe power, a renewable power source.
Sounds like a reality show. Mr. Wizard was recently on TV. I'm getting old.
No, this is years ago when I was a kid.
Yeah. Mike, is this an idea that you could see working?
I'm not sure how to market it or who I can contact, maybe someone in my local area, but like I heard you guys talking about like the WE chapters around our neighborhood.
Mike Hughes?
There are entrepreneurs around the country looking for ways to take us the next technological step. I don't see any reason why we can't all get on
our
bicycles and yeah. Provide some power.
Maybe, why go for the homeless? Get Lance Armstrong. It's a real power.
Yeah, but you can get other sorts of turbines, like there are stationary bench presses, where you can have people exercising and producing power. Well, and the money that could generate, for non-profit reasons, in my opinion.
The problem is storage batteries. Storage batteries. Mike, thanks very much for the call. And let's see if we get Stephanie on the line. Stephanie's with us from Ann Arbor in Michigan.
Hi. I was speaking to the point of why people may not be completely persuaded on the green issue. And I'm, of course, calling from southeastern Michigan, where a lot of jobs are being lost through the auto industry. And it's not so much that people aren't persuaded by the green issue, but we kind of see that as being a competing, I guess, interest with the auto industry. So people might be more concerned about keeping their jobs, you know, working on the line, creating cars, which, of course, are a huge cause of pollution. So what I'm thinking might be more persuasive would be to have, like, a joint campaign about how we can have sustainable energy, but also keep jobs within the United States. I mean, that's going to be a more primary concern for somebody to keep their job.
And might also be persuasive to John Dingell, the congressman from Michigan, who's the chairman of the House Energy Committee. But anyway, Matt, any ideas?
Yeah, these issues, I think it's important that we understand that these issues are all linked together, so that it shouldn't be a choice of whether we solve the climate crisis or we have jobs. We need to do both, and if we solve one, we will end up with more jobs. And that was part of the vice president's message today in his speech.
But maybe not in Michigan.
Well, hopefully, actually, everywhere.
Michigan. One of our goals is to create jobs for people, especially in Michigan, and coal miners. Let's find those people jobs building the new power grids that we need, building the new automobiles that we need that will run on non-carbon fuels.
The solution to the climate crisis is the solution to many, many of the other issues that face this nation, and that's what we have to understand.
You should get a copy of Mr. Gore's speech today.
I've got a copy.
He addressed it.
Yes, thank you. Stephanie, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
And Matt Williams and Mike Hughes, we wanted to thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Neil.
Thank you.
Matt Williams and Mike Hughes work for the Martin Group, the advertising agency that developed the WE campaign for the Alliance for Climate Protection, and they were kind enough to come in today and join us here in Studio 3A. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Documentary films are another way to spread the message, but even an award-winning film can still seem sometimes like castor oil. Randy Olson is one scientist attempting to turn castor oil into something more delicious. He's also a filmmaker, and his new mockumentary is called Sizzle, a global warming comedy, and he joins us now from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. Kind of you to be with us today.
Great to be here. Thanks.
And this film is your response to a public that, I guess, feels saturated with information about global warming. And you've taken the idea of, well, trying to spread the message, but also trying to have some fun with it.
Absolutely. And we tell just a simple little story here that the premise is that I am a scientist turned filmmaker who saw the Al Gore movie, thought it was wonderful, but wondered where all the scientists were. And so I set out to make my own documentary that will feature scientists, and all sorts of hijinks ensue.
Yeah, hijinks ensue. Exactly. You also cast yourself as, not to put too fine a point on it, a real jerk.
That and what a lot of the reviewers so far refer to me as hapless Randy, because I just don't quite know how to make a movie.
No, indeed, you don't. And your cameraman, one of the problems, is somebody who's a skeptic and won't keep quiet during any of these interviews.
Absolutely. And it resulted in a rather fascinating dynamic. What we ended up having was him interrupt the interviews in the middle of it to argue or disagree with the climate scientists, or in the case of the skeptics I interviewed, for him to kind of high-five them and agree with them. And it produced a different response from the people being interviewed. It kind of livened things up.
And it's pointed out later by, I guess, the sound guy later in the movie that every time you ask a question, people recite boring statistics. Every time the cameraman asks them questions, they come to life.
That is so true.
Yeah, that goes back to you being hapless and a jerk. I love this interview. We have a clip from the movie. In this, you're working with your producers, Mitch Silpa and Brian Clark, and they're obsessed with finding a celebrity host for this documentary.
This is ridiculous. We don't need a celebrity. It's stupid.
We do need a celebrity, Randy. Every single documentary needs a celebrity. It's how they get validated.
Yes,
you have to have one.
What is African hunger without Sally Struthers?
Right.
What is muscular dystrophy without Jerry Seinfeld? Lewis.
Not Seinfeld. You had it right the first time.
What is the point?
The point seems to be that, well, you get to take a shot at other documentaries and make some laughs in your own film as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, I got to say, there was one festival, without naming who it was, they told us they'd be glad to show our movie if we could provide a celebrity to introduce it. talk about life imitating our art.
The purpose behind this silliness, of course, is to provide, I guess, comic relief in order to provide cover to send the message, right?
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's a brick wall right now that the communication over global warming has run into. When you talk to film distributors, the message is very clear right now. No more global warming movies or even environmental movies. The mass audience has really grown tired of all these well-intended documentaries that just keep showing the same footage of melting glaciers and all these sorts of things. So we set out to take a little different angle to that. And, you know, it's fascinating. If you take a look at the Al Gore movie, he had the same basic orientation with his film. He and the filmmakers worked with him to try and humanize him as much as possible. They put humor into the film. They had him make a few little barb jokes. And they also tried to put some human elements in there when he talked about his son and his sister and their health problems. And he also mentioned the results of Katrina. And I ended up doing the same thing with my movie, just took it a little further in both directions. I mean, we've got really very silly humor. And then we ended up going to New Orleans last August for the 2-year anniversary of Katrina, and going down the lower Ninth Ward and finding an amazing group of people there who'd been through the hurricane, and got them together in a bar to tell their stories. And two of the women, Jean Anderson and Brenda McGee, told unbelievable stories that make people cry when they watch the film.
Again, with the point of saying this isn't an abstract issue. This is not just pictures of glaciers melting. It's not just bar graphs. These affect the lives of people every day.
That is exactly what Dr. Naomi Oreskes ends up saying in the film, which is you can gather all the scientists together that you want to talk about facts, 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 figures, 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 but you're never really going to reach people until you can put a human face on this issue of global warming. And the only place you can really do that right now in this country is to go to New Orleans, where it's not clear that the hurricane was caused by global warming, but what is clear is that it was a severe climate event and a lot of people suffered and the government wasn't able to take care of them.
Coming up, more with producer and marine biologist Randy Olson. Plus, a little bit later in the program, we'll talk with Warren Zinn about an iconic photograph he took at the start of the Iraq invasion and the death of the photo's subject. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now we're discussing how to make the green message a little bit more palatable with scientist and filmmaker Randy Olson. His film Sizzle, a Global Warming Comedy, is an attempt to cut through green fatigue. And of course, we want to hear from you. If you're sick of the message, what does it take to overcome it? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. Let's go to Mark. Mark's with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, Mark.
Sorry, I'm in the middle of work here and trying to manage things while I'm in the office. Excuse me one second. As I was calling earlier to talk, hopefully to talk to the vice president, this comes up a lot, and we hear this quite often, that solar power is so misunderstood. And I think as an astronomy teacher here in Portland and doing this across the nation for a number of miles and many trips informing the public about this, most people just don't simply understand what solar energy is. They've never had a chance to look directly at the sun. They hear about solar power. They think back to the 70s, heated panels on roofs of homes, maybe as far as they think of it, but it's much more than that. It's a tremendous amount of electromagnetic energy.
And how are you? What are you doing to make this a little clearer to people?
I took a 10,000-mile road trip across the nation about several years ago and showed people this direct image through telescopes on the sidewalks across America. And people were overwhelmed when they saw it for the first time. And I should remind people, don't ever do this with a regular telescope because it can damage the eyes. But to see the image of it actually live at the telescope through a special solar research-grade instrument stuns people, amazes them. The first time they see it, they realize that there's more going on than they'd ever imagined. So I think when they talk about the green fog of people being overwhelmed with so much talk about it, but they don't see it actually happening, it's highly misunderstood. All the parking meters here in Portland are on solar power, and you can see the panels on top of them, but you very rarely see a building or a home that has a solar unit or a voltaic cell. We're actually becoming the largest producer of these here now in Oregon, as a company from Germany has moved into the area to build these.
Well, Randy Olson, let me ask you, did you consider making a trip to the sun for your documentary?
Yeah, we crossed that off the list early on. But, you know, what he just mentioned about taking a trip like that is very important in the communication. Basically, the strongest thing you can do is to tell good stories about what's going on. And quite often doing things like that result in a very good story. It's something that the public can connect with, the human just commitment to doing those types of things. Right now, a couple friends of mine are sailing a raft full of 15,000 plastic bottles all the way to Hawaii from California, and they're about a third of the way there. And the stories that are coming out of that are incredible. So people like to cheapen it by calling it a publicity stunt, but really in this day and age of so much noise in the media world, those sorts of stories can cut through.
Let's talk with Daniel. Daniel with us from Marion in South Carolina.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead, please.
I'm about tired of the message, and I'm ready to see some action. I don't see some of the speakers, like previous Vice President Gore, not stopping his flying around to talk about this issue. He uses more fuel in his jet than I'll use in my entire life to fly around and talk about how much fuel I'm using. And I wondered if there were more people out there that feel like me that are tired of hearing the message and ready to see people that are preaching it actually do something.
So put your money where your mouth is, I think, in a nutshell.
Exactly. And while we're talking about it, I'm a big fan of radio, but radio, you take a 1,000-watt radio station, it's one of the most inefficient uses of power that we've got out there.
Well, that's arguable, but we can go to it another day. It's certainly more environmentally friendly than a newspaper. There'd be a lot of fish unwrapped if everybody got all their news on radio. But I wonder, Randy Olson, the difference between, you know, those who want to deliver the message, and in particular, it seems to me, and Daniel, thanks very much for the call, to reach people who are not necessarily already part of the choir, that seems to me what your effort is aimed at.
Absolutely. And so much of this is about voices, different voices that can reach different demographics. And I think one crucial element in so much of this is to avoid being self-righteous, because that's what starts to tangle you up with people that begin scrutinizing every little detail of what you're doing. But that is exactly what part of our goal has been. And I made a previous film 2 years ago about the evolution and intelligent design issue called Flock of Dodos. And that one did fine, but it still mostly played to the academic audience. And with this one, I really wanted to reach to a broader audience. And the essence of doing that is storytelling. I used to be a professor. I resigned from my tenured professorship and went to film school in the mid-90s. And that's one of the main things that I learned. I came to realize that science and storytelling are at opposite ends of the spectrum. Scientists value the facts and reality and the truth, and they really aren't that worried about how they structure the information. It's just about keeping everything accurate. Storytellers value a good story, and sometimes the accuracy and the truth really isn't all that important and relevant. So it's that basic tension that you end up with when you start trying to communicate all these scientific facts.
Let's get one last call in on this subject. Eric joins us. Eric calling us from Fair Oaks in California.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate it. I'm a big fan of your show. What I've done here is I set up a little group of people with all my neighbors. And we went with my son, 2 years son, to all the neighbors, asking them to be part into a meeting group. And we meet every 2 weeks to discuss about what we do in our daily life to make things a bit easier. And what I found out, especially through my wife, is that humor is the main part. Only through humor can I really communicate with people.
And what works? What jokes have worked?
It's more humor in the action. For example, I sold my lawnmower, a gas lawnmower, and purchased one of those real push mowers.
Yeah.
I'm having people running in the garden with a real mower, and everyone is laughing about it and realize it's actually very efficient, doesn't make any noise, and I'm starting to have people coming and say, okay, maybe we should buy one, or maybe we can share it. So all of this happens through humor.
So, Randy Olson, maybe you can hook up his push mower, and that'll power the projector at the theaters.
Anything for a good laugh.
Anything for a laugh. Eric, thanks very much for the call, and good luck with your efforts, and good luck with that push mower.
Thank you.
Appreciate the phone call. And Randy Olson, as you're looking ahead to try to use humor in this, anything for a laugh, but, you know, again, you got to stay on message, too.
Absolutely. And humor is such a variable element, and it divides crowds. And, you know, there's a famous expression in Hollywood about why action movies are more popular than comedies. And that's because you tell a joke, half the audience will laugh. You point a gun at them and they'll all duck. It's that variability that you run into. And I ran into it today when Nature reviewed the movie and they say the comedy falls flat. So whoever reviewed that didn't have much of a sense of humor. That's not what we found in all of our screenings with non-science, non-technical people. It's a fascinating movie because it's dividing the two crowds. What we're finding, the movie is woven of three different genres, mockumentary, documentary, and reality. And the very technical types have a really hard time with that. They can't get past any given scene. They want to know, is this person real? Is this an actor? And the broader audience just, you know, really didn't get so hung up. They just relax and have fun and roll with it. And then they're deeply hit by the emotion in New Orleans.
Randy Olson, thanks very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Randy Olson, the scientist and filmmaker behind the mockumentary Sizzle, a global warming comedy. The film premieres this Saturday at the Outfest Gay and Lesbian Film Festival in Hollywood, California. And he joined us today from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. At the outset of the Iraq War, Warren Zinn worked as a photojournalist for the Army Times. He was embedded with the 7th Cavalry Regiment. Just a few days after the invasion, he snapped several pictures of a medic running with an injured Iraqi boy in his arms. One of those photographs was splashed across front pages and on websites around the world. The medic was PFC Joseph Dwyer. And last month, more than 5 years later, Dwyer died of a drug overdose. This past Sunday, Warren Zinn wrote in the Washington Post about his feelings when he learned of Joseph Dwyer's death. And Warren Zinn joins us now on the phone from Miami. And it's nice to have you on the program today.
Good afternoon, Neil. Thank you for having me.
And first, take us back to that day in the Euphrates Valley in 2003. What happened?
Well, it was the culmination of a pretty hectic evening. The 7th Cavalry had been ambushed and attacked all night long. and it ended with a bombing run sort of on this village where these fighters were hiding inside of, right on the edge of the Euphrates River. And after the bombs had fallen, out came a gentleman carrying a white flag, and he came out and said there were injured people in the village, and the commander told him, you know, fearing that there was an ambush waiting for soldiers down there, he said, well, why don't you go ahead and bring them to the road, and we'll take care of them. And a couple minutes later, the gentleman appeared carrying this four-year-old boy in his arms. This boy's name is Ali Sattar. And his leg was bandaged up, you know, blood-soaked bandage, and carried him up the road. And then all of a sudden, to my right, you know, medic, you know, Joseph Dwyer goes running down the road, halfway down to meet this guy, and scoops up the child in his arms and comes running back towards us with the child cradled in his arms.
And what are you thinking as you're taking pictures?
That I hope it's in focus, that I hope the shutter speed's right, that that I don't mess this up, because I knew it was just really a beautiful moment that people needed to see, and that I wanted to make sure that I nailed it.
And in 1/250th of a second, you changed some people's lives.
I think so. I mean, I hope so. Some for the positive and some for the negative, but I, you know, the one thing that I hope that comes out of it is that this 1/250th of a second is now living on 5 years later and hopefully bringing some positive change to you know, to somebody somewhere. I know that since the stories ran, I received over 350 emails, most from, I've got soldiers from World War II, Vietnam, Korea, this Gulf War, you know, the past Gulf War, this war, who all sharing their experiences with me of post-traumatic stress disorder and coming home and dealing with it.
Because that's indeed what happened to PFC Dwyer. But first of all, Dwyer, excuse me. But first of all, I know you also went back to find out what happened to that then four-year-old boy.
Yeah, I went back with a reporter, and actually a crew from CNN followed us. And we went from Baghdad and drove down a couple hours to the village using a GPS location that the military had given me from where we were that night. And sort of showed the photograph around the neighborhood, and we went from house to house showing the front covers, and everybody pointed us in a different direction, and finally we were pointed to the right house, and out walked Ali's father with Ali in his arms. Ali's leg was still injured and was still, he walked with a very painful limp, so his family's, you know, carried him most of the time. And we spent the afternoon together. We shared, you know, the photo, showed them photographs, and we sat there right on the edge of the Euphrates River on a very, very hot July day. And it was pretty interesting.
What did Ali think of the picture of himself?
He was very enamored at sort of seeing his face on in this photograph. The family as a whole, I think, was just didn't quite get the gravity of it. They didn't quite get why it was a big deal. You know, to them, they were just a simple farming family living their lives on the side of the Euphrates, and that's it. You know, Ali's injured, and there's nothing they can do about it. And they didn't really understand why this was in newspapers.
We're talking with Warren Zinn, formerly a photographer with the Army Times, about an iconic photograph he took just a few days after the invasion of Iraq and its aftermath. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I know that at some point, Joe Dwyer, who left the military by then, got in touch with you to find out if you knew what had happened to the boy in the picture.
Yeah, he sent me an email out of the blue one day to see how I was doing and what was going on. And I told him that I'd actually gone back to Iraq. And he asked me, you know, about the kid and how he was doing. And I told him the story of how I went back to Iraq and we found the child. And I got an email back from him that says, quote, I can't believe you went to Iraq. And it goes on to say, I was afraid the kid didn't make it. And he said, I wish I was there with you back at that village.
In the meantime, of course, Joseph Dwyer was not doing that well himself, suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and, well, having all kinds of terrible experiences.
Yeah, I mean, he was definitely having lots of problems. I didn't know about it, and there was nothing in the emails to sort of give it away. In fact, the last email I got from him was December 1st, and he said, quote, when I first got back, I didn't really want to talk about being over there to anyone. He went on to say, now looking back on it, it's one of the greatest things I've ever done. I hope you feel the same way about what you have done. I truly believe you played an important role in this war. You told everyone's story. So, you know, from that email, no one could have possibly known that, you know, only 2 months later he was going to get arrested for shooting at Iraqis outside his door in his apartment in Texas.
Of course, there weren't any Iraqis.
Of course, and he just, you know, couldn't cope with coming back to the civilized world.
And was self-medicating with, huffing, breathing in the fumes from toxic things.
Right, and that, you know, that's what I read. I knew nothing about that. I only knew what I read. And, you know, I've spoken to his mother and to his wife a couple times since he's passed away, and, you know, they've talked about that. But, yeah.
And then there's the question of how much did his celebrity, the celebrity that you in a sense, gave him in that 250th of a second. How much did his celebrity play a role in that?
You know, the only person who would know that would be Joseph Dwyer, but I got to imagine it couldn't have. You know, is it a small puzzle piece inside the map of someone's head? I'm sure. But I think there are obviously lots of other, you know, very large issues that were going on that led to this. I think it was probably more about what he saw on the ground in Iraq than the actual photograph. And in fact, I got lots of emails from people and from people who were made famous themselves from photographs in past wars, and they said the opposite, that the photograph is what put a smile on their face, is one of the things that kept them going.
At one point, though, I know that you heard that he hated the photograph.
Yeah, you know, and his mother, when the first time we spoke after he passed away, she said to me, you know, unprompted, she said, I want you to know there were some reports that he didn't like that photograph. That's not true. He loved the photograph. He was very proud of the photograph. He just sort of was embarrassed that there were hundreds and thousands of other soldiers who were doing exactly what he was doing, and he sort of got singled out in that photograph. And I also got an email from one of his friends out in Texas, a fellow medic of his, who said exactly the same thing. So that, you know, made me feel better, that knowing that he really enjoyed it, really loved the photograph.
You've since left the journalism business. You're going to law school there in Miami. Nevertheless, that picture has changed meanings several times since you took it 5 years ago and more.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, some say the picture is iconic. I don't think it's iconic. I think, Joe Rosenthal's photograph of the flag being raised at Iwo Jima is iconic. I think this photograph was representative of what was going on at the war at the time. It was taken a week into the war. You know, whether you were for or against the war, you recognized the fact the soldiers were there and you were hoping that what they were doing was something good. And this photograph represented that at the time. And then I think 5 years later, it represents what's also going on with the war. And that's there are hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of wounded warriors that are coming home, both mentally wounded and physically wounded. And I think that this photograph represents that now. So I think it represented the war in the beginning, and I think it represents the war now.
And, of course, those wounded Iraqis who are not going to get over their injuries quickly either, if at all.
Absolutely, and I didn't mean to overlook that.
No, I know you didn't.
And that's also where it shows, too, is that we went back to see what happened to Ali, and it's unknown. And I think that's also a big part about it, is the unknown Iraqi civilians and what's happened to them.
Warren Zinn, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you, Neil.
Warren Zinn was a photojournalist with the RNE Times, now a law student with us on the phone from Miami in Florida. Tomorrow at Science Friday, Ira Flatow will be here. We'll see you again on Monday. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.